It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins. And again, to remind you, the phone number, 252 area code 726-9050. 726-9050. It's an easy way to get hold of them. Or you can reach them via digital media at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that very brief administrative responsibility out of the way, good afternoon to you, Cecil.
Hello there, Lockwood. How are you doing?
Doing well. It's good. We're getting into spring. Good. As a matter of fact, I just want to make mention of the fact that we'll be airing this Tuesday evening. And tonight at 11:06, the spring equinox occurs. So we will be officially into spring starting Wednesday morning. Just thought I'd make mention of that.
I'm all in favor of some warm weather.
Absolutely.
All in favor of that. As we know, at our law firm, we do a lot of estate planning and estate work. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to kind of address this morning some of the details that come up, kind of some simple things that just come up routinely when we are preparing estate, and today, really more specifically, the last will and testament for folks. And right out of the gate, Lockwood, our listeners realize that historically our grandmamas and granddaddies and different people would talk about in their will that they want this set of china to go to this child, mm-hmm. and they want this particular antique chest to go to this person, and they would like for this set of silver to go to this other child. And so these kinds of mentionings in their will of tangible things that you can pick up and move around, personal property, were oftentimes included in a will, sometimes even several pages in a will. Mm-hmm. That is not advisable under the new estate procedures that we now operate. It's best that we have a separate writing, Lockwood, sometimes referred to as just a memorandum or writing, concerning our tangible personal property. It's best that we not include these things, specific items of jewelry or collectibles in our will. And the reason for this is there are several reasons. First of all, Lockwood, a lot of folks still don't have those things when they actually pass on. Right. They will go ahead and distribute that in the last, you know, stages of their life. They'll mm-hmm. go ahead and turn to their daughter and say, daughter, take my, you know, diamond ring, and right. or to their granddaughter, take this particular set of china, or whatever the case might be. And when you include it in your will, the clerk of court, under the new estate administration guidelines by the Office of the Administrative Courts, is going to want a receipt signed by the beneficiary saying that they got the particular diamond or the particular set of china or whatever the tangible property is. And of course, the beneficiary is going to be uncomfortable signing that because they didn't receive that. Maybe mm-hmm. it was given to someone else. Maybe it can't be found. It can't be located. Those kinds of things. So it really is best, the devil is in the details, to just set forth a memorandum of how you would like for your tangible property to be distributed and not necessarily encumber the will with those kinds of details because they can come back to spook us.
You know, that brings up a very interesting observation. I hadn't considered that, but I can appreciate this in the sense that you have family members who, for example, their intent, they write a will. And the will was created 5 years ago. They haven't checked the will for a while. And and we'll talk about that in a moment, I'm sure. But in the process, they intended to give something to a child or distribute it to an organization, maybe. And then at the last minute, they decide, well, no, let's sell it and use the money in a different purpose. Well, here it is described in the will, but it doesn't exist anymore. I can well appreciate mm-hmm. that kind of conundrum for...
That's correct.
Wow.
That's right. Yeah. So anyway, the other good thing is that, you know, you're able to change this memorandum uh-huh. at home and at your kitchen table and, you know, at your leisure as things develop through your life. And as you give things away, you're able to modify this without necessarily having to go in and, you know, change your will. Now, another wrinkle, Lockwood, that we see is folks in their will leave, you know, $20,000 to this particular person, or $20,000 to the church. And I'm just using that amount of money and using it actually because yesterday I had a sweet couple in from Jacksonville, North Carolina, and they left $20,000 increments to about four or five different people,
right,
which is wonderful. But it can be any amount of money. It could be $50,000, $100,000, $10,000, okay? But the bottom line is, guess what, Lockwood? If you're going to include that kind of provision, which is called a specific bequest, in your will, then you're not going to be able to go to the bank and designate all of your money, joint with right of survivorship, to your children or to one child, or to or payable on death to a different beneficiary. Because guess what? The money then is not going to be in your estate in order to honor these specific bequests. So there has to be some conscious thought about this. Now, we just this week opened up a new estate where a lady was extraordinarily generous to her local church. Not only her church, but even the pastor of the church is included in a specific bequest of money. And she made several bequests to her church, which is wonderful. When I read the will, I, with the daughter who's in from out of town and she's the executor, these were wonderful things to read and so very generous of this particular person. And then, but then I thought to myself, oh my goodness, I sure hope the money is there in her, either her bank accounts or in her stock account to fund these specific bequests to the church. Because what if her stock account out there with Merrill Lynch or A.G. Edwards or Edward D. Jones is payable on death or time on death with the children, and there is then no money in the estate to honor these specific bequests? So now what could have been a very simple estate can become a complicated estate because the monies are not there to fund these specific bequests. And we would, we have options at that point. Again, it's becoming complicated, Lockwood. Do the children who are payable on death at the stock account, if you will, cough back up that money?
That's the question.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, in her will, it was actually a significant amount of money, you know, a few hundred thousand dollars. Will they do that? Okay. And what if only there were three children in this file? What if only one or two of them will do it, but a third one will not? The law is the estate cases on point are that if the funds are not in the estate, then the bequest will lapse. They will fail because the funds were not in the estate to honor those specific bequests, Lockwood. And isn't that unfortunate for a client to have, you know, potentially, you know, let's say a very, very significant stock account, a couple of million dollars or whatever, and leave, you know, $50,000 to the church? That's not what this client did. Again, I'm not speaking specifically about any particular client, but a client leaving an amount of money to people and or their church, and it then failing or lapsing because the funds are not in the estate. So be very careful about specific bequests and make sure that the monies are there. Now, yesterday when these nice folks were in the office from Jacksonville and they were giving $20,000 to any number of a few people, I mentioned to them, I said, now, you know, Mr. and Mrs., you know, Jones, make sure that you have monies in your bank not designated, not payable on death, not time on death, not joint with right of survivorship. Let's make sure that we have monies in your estate to honor these specific bequests to these five or six very wonderful people, all of which you want to have, you know, $20,000 a piece. And they completely understood. And they said that they would be cautious of that and that they would check on that, and I'm sure that they will. So now that is a detail, Lockwood, that our listeners need to be aware of.
The topic today is, if you will, the devil is in the details, and we're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins about estate planning. And of course, do want to remind you, you, as we are talking about this, may pose a question or an idea. Don't hesitate to reach out to Cecil or any of the staff there at Harvell and Collins. The number 252 area code 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Harvell and, spell out the word and, collins.com. Cecil, back to this topic of estate planning and of course the issue of the devil in the detail. You keep using the term payable on death issues, and here I've designated in my will X amount of money, varieties of organizations. The primary beneficiaries of my will be my children. Well, mm-hmm. I die, and the payable to my children, they get, if you will, if I understand it, first bite at the apple. How does
Correct.
This, what happens in this instance? So I give the money to the uh-huh. children, but I designate $20,000 to various organizations. Do they approve the distribution uh-huh. of those funds, or, you know, where, how does that work? Because to your point,
well, Lockwood, we've had a whole program on payable on death and uh-huh. time on death and joint with right of survivorship. We have posted articles on our website and on our blog about the dangers of these accounts. Uh-huh. And it just is quite unfortunate that they are so encouraged without consultation by banks, by bankers at wow. the desk in our various banks, by our stock company, our representatives, our financial representatives at different places where we hold, you know, stock accounts. And uh-huh. it's just so very easy to check that block, you know, payable on death. And of course, what gets said to the folks is, well, it will avoid probate and your children will get it immediately, mm-hmm. you know, with the presentation of a certificate of death. It won't be tied up in the court system. Well, guess what? It's not going to be tied up in the court system anyway. Your children will get it within a few weeks, if not sooner. There really is, you know, no reason, no overriding reason for these payable on death and time on death designations. And we do need to move on, Lockwood, because okay. I could spend a whole program on the downfalls of these designations. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is that you point out, yes, if the account is payable on death or TOD, POD to the children, and there is no money to provide the $50,000 to the church or the $50,000 to the Salvation Army or the $50,000 to the Habitat for Humanity, then those charities are going to suffer.
Wow.
Unless the children are willing to cough back up uh-huh. the money, knowing that their parent just simply made a mistake.
Gotcha.
The bank certainly is not going to cough up the
no.
money. The stock investment folks are certainly not going to cough up the money. And so there we are, as the lawyer, in this dilemma in the estate.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it every single day.
Wow.
Yes, as I said, when the daughter came in with her mother's estate this week, and there were such wonderful bequests to the church and even to the minister, immediately in my mind was the question, oh my goodness, I hope and pray that the account is not payable on death.
Right.
And sure enough, it was not.
Okay.
It was not. And so in that file, and the daughter was thrilled as well, that the monies will come into the estate, I might add, within 2 or 3 weeks.
Uh-huh.
What's the difference between 2 or 3 weeks and, you know, 2 or 3 days? It takes a week or so to get the death certificate
right.
anyway.
Right, right.
All right. So we can talk about that issue later, but payable on death and time on death are real legal conundrums. We just see it every single day. Now, Lockwood, another issue that needs to be talked about is that when you leave your estate out to your children, Well, you know, do you leave it to them in what we lawyers call per stirpes distribution, or do we leave it to them share and share alike and the surviving child to take all? The per stirpes distribution means that if a child were not living, then their share, their one-third or one-half or one-fourth, would go to their respective children.
Okay.
And that is a fairly typical distribution plan, that if a child is not living, their share would go to their children. Another option would be that if we have two children or three children, that they share and share the inheritance alike, and the survivor takes all, meaning that the children of a deceased child would not take their parents' share. This is something that an experienced estate planner, such as our office, you know, these are questions that are asked in detail in our law firm by our lawyers. Yes, you have three children. Tell me about John. Does he have any children?
Right.
Tell me about Sue. Does she have any children? Tell me about Mary. Does she have any children? And if the answer is yes, each of my children have children, then the question is to the client, so if, God forbid, you were to lose one of your children, would you want their share to go to their children? And, of course, the client will answer that question, and usually they say, oh, yes, absolutely. They're a little taken back by that question, and that's the reason I'm bringing it up in our wonderful discussion with you, Lockwood, this afternoon, is that, you know, these questions need to be asked. This issue needs to be addressed. What we do not want to happen in a will is just simply name that I give everything to my three children. And I see so many wills that leave it at that and do not then go into the detail of, well, what happens if the child is not living?
Right.
Okay, what happens to that distribution? And so there needs to be more detail in your last will and testament than just simply, I leave my estate to my three children.
Uh-huh.
Does it go to your three children, share and share alike, and survivor to take all? Or does it go to your children in what we lawyers call a per stirpes distribution? So that is an add-on to the all to my children that needs to be stated clearly in your last will and testament.
Mm-hmm.
And that is many times a detail that we do not see. And that, again, will send what could have been a very simple estate into a more complicated estate, and you know, and that's what we don't want. Lockwood, I've said so many times to you, you're my good friend, and
right.
we've been doing this program now for what, 25 years or
right.
20 years?
20 years.
Long time. We have so much in common with clients in estate planning.
Mm-hmm.
We want to avoid excessive cost. We want to avoid excessive delay. We want to avoid excessive taxes.
Right.
And these three things, if we don't have either per stirpes or share and share alike, if we do a payable on death and deplete our estate of assets needed to go to the charity or the church, then guess what? We're not going to avoid cost, and we're not going to avoid delay, because those are the kinds of details that can encumber an estate with multiple lawyers and months, if not years, of delay, all because on the front end, the client was not given detailed and thorough advice.
And in the process, a fourth item, it creates a lot of dissension within the family, too, potentially. So, yeah, I can appreciate the need to know in advance. Again, we're talking with Cecil Harvell of Harvell & Collins, and we're talking about the devils in the details on the issue of estate planning. There are other issues, though, that pop up like this, Cecil, where the benefactors, and I'll use that term, the members of the estate, aren't given good guidance.
Lockwood, it's so understandable that good people and good clients just don't think of these issues, for heaven's sake.
No.
The word per stirpes sounds like something out of a horror movie, doesn't it?
Right.
I mean, we can't expect good people and good clients to think of these kinds of concepts. And so it really is, you are correct, it's incumbent upon the professional to guide the client with these questions. And certainly if there are specific bequests to churches and to charities, which, as you know, Lockwood, is not unusual at all.
No.
I mean, a lot of folks will give to their church or some favored charity in the in their community. They, as we get older and many of us retire, you know, I remember my dad and mom were very active in mm-hmm. different kinds of charitable organizations, Habitat for Humanity, Salvation Army, and they and as such, the retirement community will then remember them and want to remember them in their estate planning.
Right.
So when a client mentions that they're going to leave, you know, $50,000 to Habitat for Humanity, then that is a flag to the lawyer to discuss with the client, well, now let's make sure that we have that money in the estate.
Yeah.
And so, yes, you're correct. These are the kinds of things that are important issues that good lawyers are going to discuss with good clients. Another one is alternates. Okay, we talked about the word alternate a little bit when it comes to prosterpes and share and share alike with our children. But so many last will and testaments will mention just one executor. Mm-hmm. I hereby appoint, you know, John Doe as my executor. What if John Doe is not living? Right. What if John Doe is not doing well, is sick, is infirm? What if John Doe has just... time just flies, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden John Doe is 85 years old and just simply cannot handle an estate. And so there needs to be an alternate. Always look for alternates in your appointments, if you're a fiduciary, your executor, your power of attorney. Make sure you name an alternate. I even like to name even a second alternate. I hereby name John Doe. If not, then Mary Doe. If not, then Sally Doe. Let's have a lineage of appointments so that we don't ever have to go again, delay and cost, that we don't have to go to the clerk of court, file a petition to find an executor, to find the next in line, because the document itself did not appoint an executor. Right.
If you designate first, second, and third alternates, and the first alternate is alive and competent, then immediately the activity belongs to the first alternate unless they step out of the way. Am I correct on that? So the second and third don't have to really worry about that responsibility quite yet.
That's right. That's okay. Correct.
In the case of first, second, and third alternates, and you're communicating with them, do you make sure that you're communicating with all three alternates, or just focus first only on alternate, again, number one, and then should alternate number one leave the scene, then you go back to alternates two and then eventually three?
Yeah.
No,
it would be one at a time.
Okay.
I mean, because the document appoints John Doe,
right,
and only if he cannot serve, is not living potentially, or is unable to serve, would we then go to Sally Doe, who is the alternate.
Okay.
We would then deal with Sally.
Okay.
And then, you know, right on down the line. Now, your last will and testament, this is a common question. Your last will and testament cannot be recorded. Okay, let's talk about this a minute.
Okay.
You cannot record your last will and testament. The word recording means put it on public record, because we have not died. And it cannot be recorded on public record until there's a certificate of death. And so unlike a power of attorney, unlike a deed, unlike a certificate of trust, these are all things that the Register of Deeds will record even though we are still living. A last will and testament, however, cannot be recorded. Now, what our listeners are thinking about is, but oh my gosh, Cecil, the courthouse has my last will and testament.
Mm-hmm.
I took it there. Or my lawyer told me that he put it there, she
right.
put it there. Well, that means that they put your will in safekeeping. And the clerk of court will hold your will, not record it, but hold your will for safekeeping and give you a receipt that they, in fact, have it within their vault system in safekeeping. Very, very different than it being recorded. We do not particularly recommend that a last will and testament be put at the courthouse for safekeeping, because you have to go and get it. If for some reason you want to change it or modify it, you might forget that you ever put it there. You might not recall that as we all get older, and then you can't find it at some point that you want to go locate it and can't remember that it got put at the courthouse. So it's not necessarily the number one choice that we recommend for folks. We recommend that either your lawyer keep the original in their vault system, or that you keep it in a safe place at home. Your safety deposit box, by the way, Lockwood, is just fine. You can put the will there. The burden of getting the will out of a safety deposit box is not as onerous as it once was. The clerk will allow you to get the original will very promptly, as will the banks. And so keep it in a safe place, but it's not going to be recorded at the courthouse. That's just a detail that I'd like to address, because a lot of folks ask that question.
Very interesting. Before we wrap it up, I have one quick question on the issue of memo of distribution of tangible assets, and the fact that they're giving away jewelry or a car or something of this nature. That memo, is it beneficial to somehow have it documented, that is, witnessed, because I decide that I want to just slip a new memo under my my aging parents' eyes and say, hey, this is the new memo. What's the process for that?
We recommend that the writing be in your own handwriting, that you and our wills many times say that I may leave a written memorandum in my handwriting concerning the disposition of my things, okay? And if it's in Mom's handwriting, then that will authenticate it, just because it's in her handwriting. If for some reason you do typewrite it, put it on a computer, then you're absolutely right that it should be dated and signed, and it could be notarized. It wouldn't be required that it be notarized, but it certainly would need to be, each page of it would need to be acknowledged by Mom and or Dad, so that there's just no question about it.
Do clients, do you find, oftentimes ask questions about the will and last will and testament, or are they pretty, shall we say, I'll use the word passive, they just come in, we want to do a last will and testament, but don't quite often know what questions to ask, I guess?
There's just no question about that. It was the wonderful thing that I enjoy every day, you know, helping people put the pieces of the puzzle together. That's the way I describe it. And it is very true, Lockwood, that we don't know our pieces of our puzzle.
Okay.
And that's okay. I also say that I could talk for a long time, Lockwood, about all of this. I've been doing it for a long time, and I so enjoy it. But that's what we say to folks. Just come on in and make an appointment. The lawyer will ask the questions.
Okay.
If you wait until you are all organized, you have everything that you think that you need, you have every document, you have every title, you have every account statement, you have all the full names of your children and their addresses and their Social Security number, and on and on and on and on, guess what? You're never going to make your appointment.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're hearing the recommendation. Make that appointment. Don't hesitate to get, well, seriously, don't hesitate to give Harvell and Collins a call. That number, 252 area code 72690.
One just last little thing. I don't mean to be trite there, Lockwood. We'll be glad to take the details, and we will find them.
Right.
But the lawyer will lead you through the process, is what I'm trying to say.
But that's the reason I asked that question, because so many of us think, oh, well, I've got to have it all the I's dotted, T's crossed. The responsibility, really, if you will, if you're hiring a good lawyer, is the lawyer will guide you in that process. That's my conclusion on this. Again, I want to remind you, a simple phone call, 252 area code 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Lockwood.